The EU votes to begin membership talks with Ukraine.
So Viktor Orban left the room. The other 26 leaders voted in favor, and the measure passed.
Plus, we visit the Indonesian hospital in Gaza.
The evacuation was very frightening. This bus that had a capacity of 50 passengers had to carry 120 to 150 people. We were all cramped inside, including wounded patients. By the end of the journey, we all thought the patient next to me had died because he was so still.
And later, the economy in the West Bank is suffering as war between Israel and Hamas continues to rage. Today is Friday, December 15th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The EU Commission voted Thursday to begin membership talks with Ukraine and Moldova, and on Friday, EU leaders remained optimistic about providing financial support for Ukraine during the second day of the EU's summit in Brussels. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban vetoed a major European aid package for Ukraine on Friday and warned that he could still halt Kyiv's accession to the bloc after membership talks won EU approval. Leo Varadkar is the Irish Prime Minister.
So essentially, yesterday we got agreement on talks opening up with Ukraine and Moldova and becoming full members of the EU, but we couldn't get agreement on revisions to the budget. So the extra money that we need for Ukraine, but also for other issues like cracking down on illegal immigration, we weren't able to agree the money for that, unfortunately. So it's going to require another meeting, most likely in the new year. Disappointing. We're here till about 2 o'clock last night, hoping that we could come to agreement. We got to a text that 26 member states could live with, and one could not, and it wasn't possible to convince Prime Minister Orban to agree to that. So it looks like we'll just have to regroup next year.
On Thursday, the European Union's 26 other national leaders took the historic step of agreeing to start accession negotiations with a country at war, bypassing Orban's grievances by letting him leave the room. But hours later, they could not overcome the resistance from Orban, who maintains close ties to Russia, for a revamp of the bloc's budget to channel $55 billion to Ukraine and to provide more cash for other EU priorities, such as managing migration. The EU leaders said they would try again in January, voicing optimism that a deal could be clinched then. Although membership would likely be many years away, the decision at the Brussels summit took Ukraine a step closer to its long-term strategic goal of anchoring itself in the West and liberating itself from Russia's orbit. Sonia Dean is an editor for Politico. She's based in Brussels and was at the summit.
This is a super interesting story and probably one of the most exciting twists at the European Council summit of EU leaders that I've attended over the past year. And the way it went down, Viktor Orban walked in saying, not going to happen. You know, we're not going to vote in to allow Ukraine to open these accessionist negotiations. And then the discussions went until very late. So 26 member countries were basically on board with this, only one opposing Viktor Orban. And so at some point, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz decided to kind of offer him a way out and said, why don't you go for a coffee? Apparently, we learned later this was prearranged, so they may have agreed this beforehand. So Viktor Orban left the room. The other 26 leaders voted in favor, and the measure passed.
Now, he didn't just go for coffee. He was given a bit more of an incentive than that to leave, yes?
So the EU has been holding back, I think it's around $30 billion altogether, of funding from various... Well, they've been holding it back because of rule of law issues that are ongoing and have been... you know, ongoing for some years. And ahead of the European Council Leaders Summit, the European Commission did release about $10 billion of those funds. Now, they say it's not related to, you know, the upcoming, the decision that was coming up. but it was kind of understood as a gesture of compromise that might expect a compromise in return.
So Orban got his 10 billion euros. Ukraine gets the negotiations for membership started. There's also the issue of, I think it's around 50 billion euros in aid for Ukraine that the EU summit was also going to discuss. What's the status of that?
Right, the so-called Ukraine facility. And it's 50 billion, approximately, euros over 5 years, starting from 2024. And it's part of this, larger budgetary package that includes all kinds of aspects. And this was something that leaders had hoped to also discuss and agree over the course of this summit. Now, after the accession, the EU accession agreement, they went on to negotiate further on this, and into the night. And apparently, Viktor Orban did hold out his veto strongly there. So what this kind of a typical, EU fudge was that they kicked the issue to January. They've called an extraordinary summit in January. And at that point, they're going to discuss these 50 billion along with, the rest of this. It's called a multi-annual financial framework for, the years to come for the EU. So it basically gives them some weeks time to figure out what needs to happen in order to get that yes from Orban.
Well, we'll all be waiting to see what happens. Sonia Dean is an editor at Politico in Brussels. Sonia, thank you for your time today.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Not surprisingly, people in Ukraine are happy about the positive news from Brussels. However, while Ukrainians were eagerly awaiting the decision, Russian forces launched several missile attacks targeting the Ukrainian capital and western regions. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv has more.
On Thursday, EU leaders agreed to open membership negotiations with Ukraine and Moldova and to grant candidate status to Georgia. The vote to start negotiations with Ukraine and Moldova was taken without Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who left the room, which made it possible to avoid his veto. This long-awaited decision for Ukraine was received extremely positively by Ukrainian society. Many believe this is one of the biggest Ukrainian victories in these past 2 years of a full-scale Russian invasion. The decision of the EU leaders means that the European Commission will begin to prepare the technical aspects of negotiations with Ukraine on membership, the so-called negotiating framework. The framework can be approved as early as the next EU summit in the spring of 2024. After that, it can still take years for Ukraine to become a full member of the EU. President Zelensky called the European Union's decision a victory for everyone. Victory for Ukraine, victory for all Europe. The victories it motivates, inspires and strengthens, Zelensky wrote in X. President of the European Council Charles Michel called the decision a historic moment that showed the strength of the EU. According to Michel, EU leaders continue the negotiations on the framework and discussions are difficult. In addition to the opening of accession negotiations, three important decisions related to Ukraine are being discussed. The European Council also supported an increase in funding for the European Peace Fund, which compensates member states for military aid to Ukraine to meet Kyiv's future military needs. However, Charles Michel confirmed that Viktor Orban blocked the adoption of the mega package, which included 50 billion euros for Ukraine, spending on migration programs, funding for the EU Solidarity Fund and defense. He emphasized that the package was not rejected but postponed. The leaders agreed on an additional summit which will be devoted to this issue, which possibly could be held in January 2024. While Ukrainians were waiting for the European Council's decision, Russian forces launched a series of missile attacks on Ukraine. The air raid alert was heard on the whole territory of Ukraine all day long. During one of the attacks, Russian forces launched three Kinjal hypersonic ballistic missiles targeting the Ukrainian capital Kyiv and western regions. One of the missiles was destroyed by Ukrainian air defense. No casualties or damage were reported. Two others hit the targets in the Khmelnytskyi region. Ukrainian air forces did not comment on the consequences of these hits. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Meanwhile, in Russia, peace activists say authorities are stepping up restrictions on freedom of expression ahead of next year's presidential elections and as the war against Ukraine drags on. They point to the case of LGBTQ peace activist Alexandra Sochalenko, who faces a 10-year prison sentence for expressing her opposition to the war. Marcus Harton narrates this report from the VOA Moscow Bureau.
Alexandra Sochalenko is a Russian artist and peace activist who, at the beginning of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, went to a supermarket in her native city of St. Petersburg and switched the price tags of products, replacing them with anti-war slogans. That led authorities to charge her with discrediting the Russian army. And after a year and a half of so-called preventative detention, she has been sentenced to 7 years in prison. We are showing drawings that Alexandra makes in prison, where we are told she is suffering physically and psychologically. The person relaying this is Sonia Sobotino, Alexandra's partner, who sees the future with pessimism, especially after the Russian government this month included the LGBT community on its list of extremists, along with Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State militant group. Sobotina says she doesn't have any hope. She says the situation in Russia now is very difficult, and it's getting worse every day. Now, she says, she is labeled an extremist simply because she is a lesbian. It's something she says she has never hidden, and now she fears that the authorities may punish Alexandra for being an extremist, which can mean she gets up to 10 years in prison. Linguist Svetlana Drugovaiko was one of the experts called by the defense to examine materials used to accuse Alexandra. The linguist's conclusions were clear. There was nothing in Alexandra's actions that could be considered an insult to the Russian army, and her report pointed out what she said was a lack of professionalism in preparing the materials. She says the documents failed to invoke any laws on the experts' activities, mentioned the criminal code without proper explanations, and included the use of poor grammar. She said the documents presented as evidence were written without regard for the basic principles of Russian law. After presenting her expert opinion, Svetlana was removed from her position as a professor of language study for 40 years at St. Petersburg State University, accused by a commission of professors of committing an immoral offense. She found the language humiliating, since it was the same as the university used in 2019 to expel a professor who murdered and dismembered his lover, a university student. Critics say Alexandra's prison sentence and Svetlana's expulsion from her job are a clear sign that the repression is now directed not only against politicians, but also against civil society at large. Nikolai Rybakov is chairman of the liberal Yabloko party. He views the sentence as an attempt meant to deter other activists. Rybakov says the sentence is to prevent others from doing pretty much the same thing, but on a massive scale, or from taking the causes to the next step. This is why, he says, authorities feel the need to put an end to these initiatives from the very start, to make others be scared. Russia has set presidential elections for March 17th of next year, and there is concern that restrictions on freedom of expression will be tightened further. The Yabloko party's Nikolai Rybakov says there are unfortunately many grounds to believe that after the elections, the situation will be more tough, and likely very much more tough. Hopes for pacifists like Alexandra that her sentence will be reduced seem very distant as Russia enters its second winter of war. For the VOA Moscow Bureau, Marcus Harton, VOA News.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The economic impact of Israel's war against Hamas is being felt in the West Bank, too. We'll get to that story in a few moments. First, though, diplomacy. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan is in the Middle East to meet with Israelis and Palestinians. AP correspondent Donna Warder reports.
Sullivan met today with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and President Isaac Herzog, and he says getting the hostages held by Hamas freed remains important.
It is a paramount priority of the United States for our citizens, but also for all of the rest of the hostages, and I found it to be a priority for every member of the government.
Sullivan is also meeting today with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, and a senior U.S. official says the two could discuss reactivating Palestinian security forces driven out by Hamas in its 2007 takeover of Gaza. But any role for Palestinian security forces in Gaza is likely to elicit strong opposition from Israel. I'm Donna Warder.
The Israel-Hamas war has upended the lives of foreign health workers at medical facilities throughout Gaza. Among them are Indonesians at the Indonesian hospital in northern Gaza. VOA's Yuni Salim has more.
Fikri Rofiul Haq is among three Indonesian humanitarian volunteers at the Indonesian hospital in Beit Lahia in northern Gaza Strip, who had to be evacuated to Khan Yunis in southern Gaza in late November.
Pada proses evakuasi itu benar-benar sangat mengerikan sekali, di mana bus ini yang hanya bisa menampung 50 orang.
The evacuation was very frightening. This bus that had a capacity of 50 passengers had to carry 120 to 150 people. We were all cramped inside, including wounded patients. By the end of the journey, we all thought the patient next to me had died because he was so still.
After Hamas attacked southern Israel on October 7, the three Indonesian volunteers remained in North Gaza through much of the fighting between Israeli troops and the Palestinian group, a U.S.-designated foreign terrorist organization. At the start of Israel airstrikes, a missile struck a hospital vehicle, killing a Palestinian driver. A larger attack occurred on November 20th, killing a dozen people and prompting the hospital to cease activities and evacuate its staff and patients. Local staffer Durholm Abu Ibrahim, who evacuated with the Indonesian volunteers, says before the war, the hospital played an important role in Gaza.
There are many hospitals in North Gaza, but most are smaller. The Indonesian hospital in Gaza can do procedures like brain surgery with the advanced equipment that it has.
The Israeli military has provided evidence showing Hamas using hospitals to conceal their activities, including through a network of underground tunnels.
They launch rockets on Israel 75 meters from an hospital.
U.S. officials haven't seen intelligence suggesting such a structures exists at the Indonesian hospital. Representative from Mercy Indonesia, the Indonesian nonprofit that funds the Indonesian hospital in Gaza, are skeptical that their hospital was part of the militant group's network. Eddie Wahyudi led the construction of the hospital from 2011 to 2016. He described what he found at the site when building began.
We dug 6 to 8 meters in, but didn't find the structures that were said to be like tunnels. In that depth, we only built a basement.
One political analyst told VOA that staffers at Gaza hospitals might not be actively colluding with Hamas or aware of Hamas activities near the facilities.
Not all of the hospitals in Gaza have tunnels under them. And even those that have tunnels, they are separated in a way where most of the patients and most of the hospital doctors and most of the nurses are not aware that Hamas is operating underground.
Mercy is now raising funds among Indonesians who have long sympathized with Palestinians, with the aim of helping Gazans reconstruct their life following the war.
Ini kan 30.000 lebih ya orang yang luka-luka, Bu. Ya, pasti kan buntung kaki, mata buta lah macam tangannya kan.
30,000 or so wounded, we're prepared to provide prosthetic legs or arms and help with the patient's physical rehabilitation.
The Indonesian hospital in Gaza has been in operation since 2016. But according to hospital workers, the fighting has left it so damaged, it may never open again. Yuni Salim, VOA News, Washington.
And finally today, economics. The war between Israel and Hamas means the economy in the West Bank is suffering. Employees of the Palestinian Authority have not been paid properly in weeks, and work permits for Palestinians working in Israel have been revoked. These are just two of many issues. In this report from Ramallah in the West Bank, Henry Wilkins speaks with tradesmen whose businesses have ground to a halt, while commentators say the squeeze could lead to civil unrest.
In one of Ramallah's industrial zones, Abu Mohammed Yaqub, a metal fabricator who makes grills for windows and gates, says since the war started in October, customers have little money and checks from those who have put in orders usually bounce. He says prices from his suppliers have skyrocketed. Yaqub says no one can go to Israel for supplies because travel permits have been taken away. That's why products and raw materials are more expensive, he says. Anyone who still has stock from before the war is selling it at higher prices. Permits to work in Israel have been revoked too. According to the Palestinian Ministry of the National Economy, since October 7th, Israel has revoked travel permits for as many as 130,000 Palestinians who previously worked or did business in Israel, making it hard, if not impossible, for them to earn a living. Israeli politicians have cited security concerns over Palestinians entering Israeli territory as the main reason. But problems with the West Bank's economy due to the war do not end there. Because the West Bank does not control its borders, Israel collects import taxes on its behalf. Since October, the Palestinian Authority, which administers the West Bank, has refused to accept the tax payments in protest after Israel sought to withhold some of them due to the war in Gaza. Since then, the PA has not been able to fully pay employees, like Muafe Elbaguti, who works in a department focused on countering Israeli settlements in the West Bank. Of course, the economic situation affects us, he says, but we have to cope with the conditions imposed by the occupiers. They say the policy is to avoid paying salaries for terrorist families, but this is an Israeli policy targeting every Palestinian. Elbaguti says he has received only around 17% of his usual pay in the last 3 months. More Israeli checkpoints on the roads are causing problems too. Independent analyst Ismat Mansour says the impact of Israeli checkpoints is significant. It means agricultural products that need to be moved rot, and products are damaged and delayed. He says everything takes more time, gas and transportation expenses, making products unprofitable for Palestinians. On whether there's an end in sight to the West Bank's economic woes, one expert said Israel will likely have to let Palestinian workers back in eventually.
They're talking about starting from perhaps doing gradually different ages or doing more security checks. I'm not sure they're doing it at the right pace, but I think this is going to happen. How quickly? Let's see.
There's concern among political commentators that unless something is done soon to end the squeeze in the West Bank, it could lead to civil unrest and more security problems for Israel. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Ramallah, the West Bank.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA Podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.